We're talking about how colonies of honeybees live in the natural world. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Wild colonies of bees are surviving and, dare we say, thriving. They're maintaining their numbers. And look at this contrast. About 40% of the colonies managed by beekeepers are dying off each year. So why is that? What do you want to know about honeybees? What have you wondered about their colonies or about their social lives? We're at 800-642-1234, taking your questions through the hour. Thomas Seeley is a Cornell University biology professor. He's the author of 5 books on bees, and his new one is called The Lives of Bees, The Untold Story of the Honeybee in the Wild. Thomas, welcome to the Ideas Network.
My pleasure to be with you. Thank you for having me.
So when I think of honeybees, I think of their hives and the man-made kind without even realizing it. But your book is focusing on how honeybees live in the wild. So what does a wild bee colony look like?
It's from the outside, it looks like usually a tree where the bees are living in a hollow inside that tree. And then inside, the colony looks kind of like the inside of a beekeeper's hive, but everything's not—it's not a square box. So there are combs in there, those combs are covered with about 20,000 worker adult bees and a queen bee and some drones. And then within those combs, there's the colony's brood and its food stores.
So you discovered your first wild honeybees in the wild at the age of 11. Can you take us back to that experience and what it was like discovering honeybees in the wild?
Sure. Yeah, that was really my introduction. It was I was walking down the road near our house in the countryside outside of Ithaca, New York, and I saw a swarm of bees, or actually I didn't even know it was a swarm of bees, but I heard the buzzing of thousands of bees, and then I was going down the road, and I saw them starting to move into a big black walnut tree where there was a hole about an inch and a half diameter in a limb of that tree. And so that was the bees brought themselves to me in a sense. And then at first I was quite scared of the bees, but I learned that I could watch them without being stung if I just sat quietly and still, but right by that limb.
Yeah, you even got a step stool, I think, and you were able to get a little bit closer, realizing that you could get close.
That's right. But at first, I stood across the road. I wasn't sure what to do, but little by little, I found that okay, I can get closer. Nothing's happening, and as you say, I went and got a step ladder. And got up so I could get my eyes quite close to just a few feet from the entrance of that natural nest of bees up on top, sitting on top of the stepladder, which wasn't very smart. it's not stable, but it was good.
So when you discover a wild honeybee colony in the wild now, do you get that same rush of emotions?
I do get a rush of emotions, but it's a rush of emotion of appreciation that these animals that we humans have had under our supervision for really thousands of years are still able to live all on their own. They don't need us, and they can do just fine in the wild. And of course, that's where they evolved to live and had been living for really, as we now know, millions of years until humans came along and devised hives for them to live in as well.
And so when humans develop these hives, are the wild bees we're talking about the same species as the honeybees that the beekeepers work with now?
Yes, it's exactly the same species, Apis mellifera. And in fact, genetically, the bees are virtually the same as well, though there are some differences between depending on where you are, they're sometimes the wild bees have undergone natural selection, whereas the managed honeybees have undergone artificial selection. But it is really basically the same bee. And any beekeeper can tell you that his or her colonies will cast swarms which move out into the woods, and correspondingly, beekeepers collect swarms and put them in their hives. So the bees go back and forth between beekeepers and bees and trees.
We're talking with Thomas Seeley. He is a biologist at Cornell University, author of the book called The Lives of Bees, The Untold Story of the Honeybee in the Wild. A bee's food collection operation extends more than 40 miles around its nest, and it finds flower patches about 3 miles from its home. What do you wonder about the bees in your own backyard? Are you a beekeeper, or do you like to watch them in the wild? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Thomas, we've seen the headlines that American beekeepers lost about 40% of their honeybee colonies last winter, and that's been something that we've seen consecutive winters. Can you tell us more about that? What's going on?
Yes. The main thing that's going on that produces this very high mortality of colonies over winter, and it's much higher than it used to be. It used to be 5 to 10%. Now it's up to 40% for colonies under management. The main thing that's causing that is an introduced parasitic mite that lives on the bees, on the outside of the bees, and it disrupts their physiology, weakens the bees, and it spreads some viruses that make the bees very, very sick. So that's what's increased the colony mortality.
And these mites that you talk about, they're found in the wild as well. Is that right?
Yes, every honeybee colony probably in North America has these mites. So that begs the question: how come the colonies in the wild are doing better than the ones in beekeepers' hives? And it's a complicated story, but it has two general parts. One is they have better genetics. They've evolved mechanisms of fighting off the mites. And secondly, they have better genetics, and they also have a better lifestyle. There are many things about the way they live which makes their lives less stressful and healthier.
What about their lifestyle that helps them thrive in the wild?
Several things. Let's start with their nests. One of the fundamental manipulations that a beekeeper makes is the beekeeper puts a colony of bees in a very large nesting space or hive, and that's done by us. I'm a beekeeper, and a beekeeper does that to give the bees lots of space to build up a big colony and to store up lots of honey. Now, out in the wild, the bees don't really need a big colony, and they don't need to make a surplus of honey, so they live in much smaller nest cavities, and that makes them much less of a bonanza host for these parasitic mites. It also means that colonies go through a process called swarming, and that creates a period in the summer when the colony does not have brood. After it swarms, it gets a new queen. It takes a while to get the new queen online. And when a colony does not have brood, there's no material on which the mites can reproduce. So that inhibits the mites' population growth.
We're learning how honeybee colonies function when they live in the wild. The book is called The Lives of Bees, and author Thomas Seeley stays with us. Do you farm? How important are honeybees to your crops? How would you describe the current state of pollination for your crops? And what do you want to know about honeybees? All questions answered at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. We are learning about wild honeybees here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Pollinators are responsible for one of every three bites of food we take, and domesticated honeybees do the big lift here. Commercial honeybee colonies are a key part of farming, and the so-called angels of agriculture are an essential part of our flowering crops. Think blueberries and almonds and cherries. But what happens when honeybees manage their own affairs? How do they live without beekeepers? Questions we're exploring along with yours at 800-642-1234. Are you a beekeeper? How are your colonies doing right now, and what mistakes have you made along the way? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Cornell University biologist Thomas Seeley's new book is called The Lives of Bees, and he stays with us for the hour. Thomas, you were talking about the spacing between the bees, and you have more than a dozen ways the life of a honeybee in the wild differs from the life of a honeybee managed in colonies. When you look at honey production, how much honey do bees make in the wild compared to what you find in a colony managed by a beekeeper?
In the wild, a colony produces only the honey it needs to survive a winter. And so that's about 40 or 50 pounds. Now, a beekeeper, depending on his or her location, will manage a colony so it can produce hundreds of pounds. I think the most I've ever produced from a colony of bees is probably been about 300 pounds of surplus honey on top of what the bees need. So you can see that that's quite a difference, 40 or 50 pounds versus 300 or 350 pounds.
How do beekeepers get that type of output from the bees?
Yeah, you're getting at a really important aspect of the difference between wild colonies and managed colonies. A beekeeper gets that kind of production by putting the bees in a much larger nesting space, putting them in a bigger, giving them much more room for the colony to grow and to store up food than the bees choose for themselves in the wild. To put a number on that, a tree cavity and the bees are careful about choosing the size of the cavity that they occupy. It's usually only about the size of one box that a beekeeper uses for his or her hives. It's called a hive body or super. If a beekeeper manages a colony to make honey, they will put will give the bees four or five of those boxes. So the homes of a managed colony can be often are four or five times larger than the homes of a wild colony.
So take us through a typical day for a wild honeybee. What is their day like?
Well, their day is really identical to the day of a managed colony. It's just things are done on a smaller scale. The colony is smaller. So it starts in the morning with scout bees. As soon as the temperature gets above about 50 degrees, bees that we call scouts or scout foragers go out. These are the enterprising bees. They go out, they find things, they come back and they report their discoveries with a waggle dance, and they get the ball rolling. And it takes the bees fully about most of the morning to get the colony to really be humming along. And then it keeps working until really sunset. So during the day, meanwhile, back in the nest, most of the bees actually work at home. These are the nurse bees and the bees that build the combs and so forth. They're taking care of rearing new bees, keeping the nest warm, keeping the nest clean, defending the nest, processing the food that the foragers are bringing home.
So what is this waggle that you talk about, and how do bees communicate with each other?
Well, one of the things that's very special about honeybees, and it's really that they're unique in this regard, is their ability to indicate abstractly the locations of rich food sources. There are only two, and the bees do it with a waggle dance. It's a dance where the bee performs this waggling motion on the surface of one of the vertical combs in the nest, and it's a little hard to explain over the radio, but... in that dance, they encode information about the direction and the distance to a flowering tree or a patch or a field with profuse flowers, and thus they can indicate the locations of rich food sources outside the hive. And there's only to be able to do that abstractly like that, without actually leading the other individual out to this wonderful food source, there's only one other species that has that ability, and that's ourselves. So that's honeybees and human beings share this remarkable communication ability.
How did scientists even discover the waggle dance as a thing? I mean, you would have to, how would you even discover that?
It was discovered in the following manner, and this happened back in the early 1910s. There's a German scientist, Carl von Frisch, and he was studying, it was color vision in the bees, and he had bees living in what we called an observation hive, a glass-walled observation hive, in his laboratory in Munich. And for his experiments, he needed bees to come out of his observation hive and go to a little table where he had a dish of food, and he put colored discs underneath the food, and that was part of his color testing. And he noticed that when he would start his work each day, it might take a while for the first bee to discover that, oh, he had renewed his little feeding station for the bees. But once one bee had discovered it, then others piled out very quickly. And so he then looked inside the hive, and it's a long story, but that was how he discovered that these bees have an ability to, once one bee has found a rich food source, to announce that discovery to other bees.
We're talking with Thomas Seeley. He's a biologist at Cornell University. The new book is called The Lives of Bees, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you wonder about with honeybees? Have you seen bees in the wild nesting in a tree? How did you observe them? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@WPR.org. Thomas, let's talk about reproduction, because now I kind of feel like the saying, the birds and the bees. I mean, if you know about bee reproduction, you know a lot about how things multiply. And so there are the male bees, the drones, and these virgin queens that go on this maiden voyage. That's kind of risky because they're not with any other bees. How do things go down?
Yeah, you've put your finger on probably the riskiest part of the biology of a honeybee colony. It's when its queen, a young queen, goes out on her mating flight. And she flies out and makes a flight. It can go out for miles to go and find to a place where it's a hookup site for honeybees, where there's lots of drones hanging out. And she'll mate there with a dozen or more of the males. But she's, as you said, she's doing this all on her own. And it's really the only time in a queen bee's entire life when she's by herself. So it's a risky time. And she's a very important member of the colony, of course, being the genetic heart, the mother of all the other bees. So it's a matter of flying out to a special area, mating, and then working your way home quickly.
Okay, so, and you estimate that the total number of sperm received by the queen on a mating flight, on one mating flight, can exceed 100 million?
Yes, that's right. People have carefully dissected out the organ called the spermatheca that holds the sperm in suspended animation that the queen bee has acquired on her mating flight. And she will hold on to this. She will rely on that sperm that she acquires during that one mating flight for the rest of her life, which could be a year or more. So, she's well stocked with sperm.
So, and that is to make sure that the hive is diverse, or, you know, why so many?
Good question. Why so many? It turns out that there are multiple benefits of having diversity among the workforce within a colony. One of the most striking is it improves the disease resistance of the colony to have a genetically diverse population. But it has other effects too. One of the most curious ones, which I find interesting, is that it really helps the food collection process as well, because bees, depending on their genetics, they can be either very eager beavers or they can be more reserved. And what has been found is that one of the consequences of the queen mating multiply is she has she'll produce a few workers that just get going in the morning in terms of the foraging operation. They just start their foraging activity earlier than others, and they're like the spark plugs for the rest of getting the whole colony foraging operation going. And if you remove those bees, things start very slowly. So a lot of different ways it's good to have at least for honeybees, to have a really diverse population of members of the colony.
The book is called The Lives of Bees, and author Thomas Seeley stays with us. We are untangling the complex relationship between us humans and honeybees and how we can be better stewards. Do you love insects? Why do you marvel at honeybees? And what have you watched them do? Join in at 800-642-1234. Send your honeybee questions by email to ideas@wpr.org. Coming up, we'll learn about Darwinian beekeeping and a more natural, gentler approach to managing the lives of honeybee colonies. That's after this news update right here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about honeybees that live on their own in nature and how their lives can enlighten beekeeping practices. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're exploring the lives of the bees that make their home in the forests around Ithaca, New York. Why do you marvel at honeybees? What have you watched them do, and have you considered becoming a beekeeper? What's held you back? Join in this hour's discussion at 800-642-1234. And Cornell University biology professor Thomas Seeley has spent nearly a half century studying the behavior and the social life and the ecology of honeybees. His new book is called The Lives of Bees. Let's go to the phones now with Monique joining us from Plainfield. Hi, Monique.
Hi, good morning.
So what's on your mind about honeybees?
Well, I have been an amateur beekeeper for about 7 years now, and the amount of just absolutely fascinating and wonderful things that I've been able to watch the bees do and that I've been able to experience is just incredible. My first year as a beekeeper, I was lucky enough to be able to capture 2 swarms that had come from the traveling beehives in my area. You know, the ones that the professional beekeepers move around and swarms come off of them pretty frequently. So my very first year, I got to capture 2 swarms. And then my second year, I got to watch one of my hives swarm, which wasn't necessarily the greatest thing, but it was so interesting to watch. But I've actually given speeches to help to encourage other people in a college class to become amateur beekeepers, because it's just endlessly fascinating and rewarding, and it's just one of the most wonderful things that we do.
Monique, thanks so much for the call. Thomas, she's captured colonies from traveling bee colonies. What do we know there?
Yeah, that points out that illustrates this exchange that goes on between colonies that live in the hives of beekeepers. They cast swarms, and some of them are caught by other beekeepers, and many of them move out into the woods, and vice versa. The beekeepers can catch swarms that come out of the woods. And one thing that's illustrated by that call is that most beekeepers are familiar with bees that are living in beekeepers' hives. Monique was familiar with her bees in her hives and with the migratory beekeepers, the bees in their hives. Very few beekeepers realize that there is a population of bees living in the wild. And in New York State, where I know more than the other states, it's easy to calculate that there are many more colonies living in the forests in New York State than there are in beekeepers' hives. So these wild colonies are still very important, and numerically, and also in terms of informing beekeeping, in the sense that with any, for beekeepers, most beekeepers know only about how bees live in their hives because that's what they're taught in beekeeping classes. And I wrote this book to remind people that almost for the first time, just how bees live when they get to control, when they are in control of their lives. And it's so different from how the lives they lead, under management by beekeepers. And I think for any animal or plant that we manage, it's useful to know what the lives of these organisms are like when they get to use all of the adaptations that they possess, all of their natural abilities to live and survive.
It feels like we need the honeybees more than they need us.
I think that's true. The bees do not need us, really. In fact, they actually, at least in where I live, they live better in the woods than they do in beekeepers' hives. And there's several reasons for that. One we've touched on already, the management of hives fosters colonies to get really supersized, and that makes them wonderful hosts for the troubling parasites they have now. But also, the beekeepers, including myself, we put the hives close together in apiaries for convenience and to make it economically more manageable. But it also makes it very easy for disease to spread between colonies or hives of bees. In nature, they live about more than a half mile apart on average, instead of like a few feet apart. And so those are some of the differences that exist. Also, in nature, the bees are they're steadily exposed to natural selection for things like disease resistance and resistance to these mites. Whereas beekeepers, we treat the managed colonies for mites. We give them miticides, and thus we blunt the natural selection for bees that have natural resistance to these mites. So there's a lot of things about beekeeping which I think we take for granted when you're trained as a beekeeper. You learn about beekeeping. You think, oh, this is how bees live, and this is the way to do it. Mm-hmm. And I wrote this book to give us a reference to say, well, how do they live? How do they live when they're all on their own and they get to control their lives themselves?
Let's bring in another call now. Gabriel from Viroqua is with us. Hi, Gabriel.
Hi there. How are you?
Doing well.
Great. My question is about the difference between the nutrition that wild hives get, wild colonies versus managed colonies. So, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
And when she's talking about nutritional differences, Gabrielle, what do you mean specifically if you're still there? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm still here. Well, I know that a lot of beekeepers, if not all of them, they'll harvest all the honey from a hive and give a colony sugar water to live over the winter or something like that. And I wonder if that has an effect on their health and their ability to resist diseases and what might spring and things like that.
Yeah, thank you so much for the question. Thomas, what do we know about nutrition?
Yeah, that's a really important question. I'm glad Baroque asked that question. There are a number of really salient differences between bees living off on their own out in the wild versus under management. For one thing, probably the most striking one is that the food is generally cleaner for colonies living away out on their own, out in the woods, in forested areas. For example, so many bee colonies, managed colonies, live in the vicinity of where corn is planted. And as you probably know, most corn seed now is equipped with genes that produce insecticides that are inherent to the corn plant. So these insecticides are even included in the pollen from the corn plant. And the bees get into that, and it just kills colonies like crazy. I was just up in Ontario, Canada, where the beekeeper meeting, and they could really just show on a map where the corn is planted, the bees die. So that's one difference. The food is clean for colonies out in the wild. It also tends to be more diverse because when they're out in the wild environment, their food sources are small and patchy and diverse. They're whatever wildflowers or they can find in the area. And those can be on trees as well as in shrubs and in swamps and all sorts of places. So it's a little bit like our situation, as we know for our own diet. If it's clean and it's diverse, it's better nutrition.
We're talking with Thomas Seely, a biologist at Cornell, author of the book, The Lives of Bees. There's still time for your questions, 800-642-1234. Email them to ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Bill in Osseo. Hi, Bill.
Hi there.
And I hear a radio in the background, but
I'll turn it down. That's your radio.
So Bill, what is your question about honeybees? What would you like to add?
Well, I'd like to just say, first of all, that I'm afraid of honeybees. Bees generally, I'm afraid of. And how do you get rid of that fear? Because I'll bet you, bees can tell it.
How do we get rid of a fear of bees, Thomas? Any idea?
Yeah, I think you get rid of the fear of bees the way you get rid of the fear of anything that's scary initially. You get exposed to it in a way that shows you that the fear is unfounded or is exaggerated. And so you would go to a beekeeper and you could say, can you show me how you take care of bees without getting stung? And having that, you might stand back at a distance at first, and then you'd get closer, and you'd discover it's actually safe. Honeybees, contrary to popular depiction in cartoons and things like that, honeybees are reticent to sting. They only will sting another animal nearby if they feel like that it's their nest is being disturbed. So, if you work slowly and gently with bees, they don't sting. And beekeepers reinforce that by smoking the bees, which makes the bees, gives them a sense that their nest is in danger, and their focus becomes not on defending the nest, but retreating inside the nest.
And so when you're working in a hive, you do some of the smoking first?
That's right. And we're just learning that it used that in the wild, what happens if the bees smell smoke? They retreat deep inside their cavity, because usually when a forest fire goes through an area, if the colony stays in place and goes deep inside its nest cavity, it will survive the forest fire unless it's a massive one.
The book is called The Lives of Bees, and Cornell biologist Thomas Seely is our window into the world of wild honeybees. Are you a beekeeper? Are your bees a hobby or perhaps a full-time job in commercial production? What's it like working with your bees? Tell us about how your colony is doing right now at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with more conversation right here on the Ideas Network. We're exploring the contrast between wild honeybee colonies and the living conditions of managed hives. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and Cornell University biology professor Thomas Seely has spent the better part of his life understanding honeybees in the wild. And he writes in his latest book, The Lives of Bees, as our human population approaches a billion, we need the pollination services provided by honeybees more than ever before. Do you work in the honey production industry? Have you seen a decrease in production? How have you compensated for the die-off? Maybe you use a lot of honey for your work. Tell us about it at 800-642-1234. Email ideas@wpr.org. And Thomas Seely stays with us. Thomas, Jonathan emailed us wanting to know, do all bees make honey, such as the bumblebee, the yellow jackets? What about other pollinators like wasps? Can you break that down?
Yeah, the honeybee is the only species of bee that stores up large quantities of honey. Bumblebees, the other social bees like bumblebees, they do make honey. Again, for them, it's a food reserve, an energy reserve inside their nest, but they don't store up large quantities. And the reason the honeybees do and the others don't is that the honeybee is the only bee species that gets through winter by producing heat inside the nest all winter long to keep the bees warm and alive, and the honey is their fuel, their heating fuel for that heat production. All of the other species of bees hibernate. They go become dormant and don't keep their bodies warm through the winter. So honeybees are unique in producing large amounts of honey, but there are other species that make small quantities, thimblefuls of honey.
So even in the depths of winter, even when we're experiencing a polar vortex, these honeybees are in their nests and they've warmed up the hive somehow. How do they make it through the winter?
Yeah, they make it through the winter by producing heat, and the heat is produced by isometrically contracting their flight muscles. They've got two sets of muscles in the thorax. One raises the wings and one lowers the wings. And in flight, they use those muscles alternately to make the wings flap up and down. But in the winter, they can activate both sets of muscles at the same time, and that means the wings don't move, but heat gets produced. And so they generate, their heat production is about, it's about the same amount of heat production as a 40-watt light bulb, incandescent bulb. And that doesn't sound like a lot, but for a colony of bees that's tucked inside a well-insulated nest cavity, and the bees themselves make a lot of insulation, they make a nice ball, tight ball of bees, they can keep them in the inside of that core of that cluster. It can be 80, 90 degrees Fahrenheit, and the perimeter is state. They keep it about 50 degrees Fahrenheit. So they're pretty cozy.
You've spent decades researching honeybees. What have you seen change as you studied them over the years? How has research evolved?
Probably the biggest change in research has been the advent of genetic tools that let us understand much more clearly how the bees can use their genetic instructions to do things, just really how the genetic readout of their genes is used by the bees to produce things like their waggle dance, their heat production, things like their the variation among the individuals in whether some are eager beavers that go out in the morning and others are slower, but also important in how they fight diseases. So the genetics side of the story has really mushroomed as with the advent of these genetic tools.
And go ahead.
I was going to also say that, but another thing that has happened is we've learned so much more, also not without using the fancy genetic tools, just by careful observation. There are just a lot of biologists that have taken advantage of the unique opportunity honeybees provide for us of living comfortably inside what we call an observation hive, a glass-walled observation hive. And so we've been able to, through patient observation and experiments done in the field, learn so much more about how the internal organization of a honeybee colony, both in its food collection process, its nest heating process, and also its process of choosing a new home. So there's just, as people have gotten more interested in bees, more students have been attracted to it, more researchers, and we've just learned more both through straightforward observation but also through incisive genetic analyses.
And you're a beekeeper. What could we learn from you? How can we get more back to nature, if you will, in keeping bees?
Thank you for asking that question. There are many things one can do. If one's a small-scale beekeeper and one's not interested in producing lots of honey, and that would be a lot of beekeepers, in fact, who just really want to have bees in their backyard. There are a number of things that one can do. And before I want to go forward on sharing what those are, I want to stress that there are different ways, I feel, of being a beekeeper, just as there's different ways of relating to birds. Some people are bird watchers and others are poultry farmers. And a lot of beekeeping is more on the perspective or scale of poultry farming than bird watching. But there are most beekeepers, I think, are interested in the more interested in the bees than in having the bees be big honey producers or pollinators. So if you're in that category that you're more like a bee watcher more like a bird watcher, unless you're a bee watcher, there are things you can do. You can have it just to keep your colonies, have a few, space them out, put them in small hives, let them swarm. And you don't, if you do those things, the bees will take very good care of themselves. It also helps if you put them in a well-insulated hive, not just one of the hives that you buy from the bee supply places, which are actually quite poorly insulated. They're very good for colonies that need to be moved around, but we're learning more and more that if the bees live in a well-insulated hive, as they do when they live inside a tree, the colony is much healthier.
What might that well-insulated hive be made out of?
You would start with a hive that is a standard hive, and it's made up, the walls will be 1 inch thick, or not only 1 inch, but it's 3/4 inch thick pine. But then you would add two inches of polystyrene foam insulation on the sides and the top. And then you duplicate a natural nest cavity. And it makes a world of difference to the bees inside. For example, in the middle of the winter, there's a warm pocket in the top of the inside the hive where it's so warm the bees don't even have to go into a tight cluster. And the walls and ceiling are warm enough that water doesn't condense and drip on the bees. And so having a well-insulated hive without a top entrance or a top ventilation hole gives the bees a much cozier home, and the bees are healthier in winter. This is something we're just learning about now.
And you've been studying honeybees for the better part of a half century, and this has been your life work. You know so much about them. Are there any mysteries left to unlock about the honey-carrying bee?
Oh, my goodness, yes. I'd say, like with any living system, what we know is maybe a small percentage of what's going on. Yeah, there are, my goodness. We know there are many, many signals that the bees have inside their nests, which I have no clue about what they're doing. These are conspicuous ones where a bee will walk over and grab another bee or grab the comb and then make this sound that goes on for about 2 seconds. It goes, I have no idea what that is, for example. And how they align their comb construction. I mean, the combs are built in the nest are in perfect parallel curtains of comb. How do they do that? And when they build their nests, they build worker cells and drone cells, bigger cells to rear the drones in. How do they decide when to build the drone cells? And how do they control the production so they get the right percentage?
You have more books left in you. That's where we'll have to end it. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. My pleasure, Kate. Thank you for having me.
Thomas Seeley, biology professor at Cornell. His new book is The Lives of Bees, The Untold Story of the Honeybee in the Wild. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.